So for the discussion, the request from the cameraman goes that if anybody make a comment, then he pay attention to the microphone and the camera, so not talk back to the camera. But before the discussion, I would like to announce another self-organizing exercise. There will be a special issue of evolutionary ecology research attached to this meeting, and it will be edited by Andrew and me. And we don't want to prescribe what kind of contribution is possible to have this journals, and if anybody has idea to contribute, then contact us. The deadline for the papers will be the end of January next year, and then I ask Andrew, who is a permanent editor of the journal, to say a few words how he think about it.
So I just wanted to emphasize that all of the interesting arguments and debates and discussions and disagreements and agreements that have occurred during this meeting. I'm sure you heard what I said before, so I won't repeat it for the sake of the microphone. But I just want to say there's clearly a lot of really cool stuff to do here, a lot of cool stuff to write. And so we would welcome any contributions that have to do, to some extent, with niches and speciation, so the focus of this particular workshop. But in addition, I wanted to suggest that I could see some cool opportunities for papers that you weren't already potentially thinking of. For example, this argument about continuous coexistence. I mean, that might be a cool thing for the people who disagree on it to get together and write the definitive paper that basically illustrates this. Now, many of you probably know evolutionary ecology research. Those of you who don't, it's an independent journal. It's one that's based on the principle of cheap dissemination of results as much as possible, and the idea that basically you can be socially responsible. You don't have to support these big, rich publishers. So the idea is, so if you don't know it, and if you don't read it normally, the cool thing is that if you do a special issue, and you have a bunch of cool people contributing to it, everybody will know about it. Everybody that studies speciation will know about this special issue. So your paper will get high profile among the very people that you're trying to reach. And then finally, I also wanted to say that editing these special issues is a great opportunity to take those papers that you just ran through Nature and Science, okay? And you know they're great papers, they're really wonderful papers, but the idiot editors or reviewers at those journals were just jealous or whatever, and they didn't want to publish it there, right? But you know they're great papers, but at this point it's time to move on. You want to get it out there, you want to get somewhere where it will be noticed. This is the perfect place to submit those papers as well, okay? So hopefully January 30th was the deadline. We'll send out reminders as time goes on. Everyone is welcome to contribute papers. Hopefully we get a lot of really good ones. And once again, in addition to individual papers that you might write, view it as a potential opportunity to get together with those people you disagree with and write something new and innovative. Evolutionary ecology and our special issue will be open to all sorts of papers. If you want to have an interesting discussion paper, non-standard format, all that's a go, as long as you think it'd be a cool and interesting idea. And, of course, the editors agree to that as well. So is it okay?
Andy, thanks. That sounds great. I've got an entire issue worth of rejected Nature and Science papers. Again, can I also bring you my papers that have been rejected from Ranger Rick? You know, I've got a few. At some point, even we'll have standards. Yeah, so no, they can be sent in. Well, I would like to thank everybody for coming back. Wow, would everybody agree? The talks have been amazing. And how many of you would agree? So first, let's just give a big hand to everyone that we just spoke. It was cool. That's... The second, wouldn't you agree? And please just stand up. You guys are so wonderful. Looks like somebody just took a shower. I haven't. Liz and Geza, can you just kind of stand up? And then Gabriella, stand up. I'm just so sorry we never heard you speak. You know, she really should have had a talk, but I think she said something like the PowerPoint ate her talk or something like that. You guys have really been awesome. You have made us feel welcome while keeping us in line. You have set up a wonderful program for us. You have made it all look easy. And I know that what happens is anytime things go seamlessly, you never get credit. One only is alerted when something goes wrong. Well, nothing for me has gone wrong. You guys have been great. Please give them a, yeah, that. Also, I'm also assuming perhaps like me, you may be operating on slightly little sleep. You may have fallen in with evil companions at various points along the way and that along the way and, you know, all that sort of thing. And also, how many of you are just feeling a little bit super saturated from the talks? You know, you reach a point where your brain is filled up and you're pouring cool stuff in it, but it's just like kind of flowing off. I could sort of see that, you know, in between the stuff that was flowing out of my head, that was happening with other people. But so for the discussion, I'd really like to invite people. It'd be great, because then it makes, you know, this for me a lot of fun, is to, at the one hand, just kick back, relax. We know each other. We're friends. We're buddies. We've seen old friends, and we've made new ones. That's actually truly wonderful. But also there are some, like, cool, serious topics to be able to kind of take home. So I'd like this discussion. I would invite people to be intense and then totally informal and just kind of laid back. I know that sounds like a bit odd. So what we're going to try to do then is between now and 4:15. So if you're kind of looking at the clock and wondering when does the bar open, between now and 4:15, we're actually going to try to get through three topic areas. So don't feel bad if we cut some of the topic areas short and things like that. It's not that they aren't interesting. If they continue over beer, that would be great. Now, if everybody's talked out before we get to 4:15, that's fine. The bar's already open, so that's cool. So we will have three topics, and our first topic is going to be on the issue of coexistence and speciation. We have heard this kind of fascinating term of, does the capacity to coexist then relate to necessarily or sufficiently then to speciation? And then I want to expand the thought a little bit more. John and other talks today, of course, emphasize the fact there's a lot more to speciation frameworks than just adaptive branching. Evolutionary branching, we saw some really important and wonderful genetical research program approaches, and we saw the neutral theory approaches to looking at species diversity. And so Ola very kindly has offered to kick us off. I'm going to have three people kick us off and then, you know, then start shooting arrows at whatever you'd like.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah, I thought, like, a question that would perhaps help us to take a step back and sort of try and see if we can get the theoreticians and the theoretical ecologists and theoretical population geneticists and the empiricists sort of all think about or try and think about a question that we could address with in a language that we can all understand. And so I was thinking about this a bit, and I'd asked a couple of people for you in the last couple of days, what both empiricists and theoreticians, so what would you think, what would be the most exciting thing for you as an empiricist can ask a theoretician what they should do or vice versa. The answer very often is, well, I would like theoreticians to build models that explain my data, or, well, I'd like to have empiricists go off and collect data that help parameterize or test my models. And I was sort of thinking about my own model system, so I'm working mostly on the cichlid fish radiations in the African lakes, and I thought, my God, this is so highly dimensional. So what's happening there in terms of how the process of speciation and radiation is unfolding is so highly dimensional that I find it very difficult to sort of see how. So when I listen to the various theory talks here, I find something in each of them, in each of these models, that I feel, wow, this would be very relevant for my system. But many of these models use parameter space that is sort of orthogonal to each other, and so it's very difficult for me as an empiricist to think about how I can combine all of these to really explain my data, and I think my data are totally useless to parameterize any of your models. So therefore, I thought it would be good to really take a step back and think there's some level at which we can nevertheless talk about the same sort of the same question, no matter how highly dimensional our systems are and which dimension we choose to study. So I thought a really perhaps, I don't know if simple or not, but a question that's come back multiple times in this meeting is, like, are the conditions that are necessary and sufficient to cause speciation also necessary and sufficient to cause coexistence, and vice versa, are the conditions that are necessary and sufficient for ecological coexistence also necessary and sufficient to cause speciation. So, I mean, just to perhaps help kick it off a little bit more, so we have heard talks about situations, like empirical talks about situations where there would be, you think there is ecological opportunity or even ecological need perhaps for adaptation to happen, or there is niche space where you think speciation should go into and explore this niche space, and it doesn't happen. And empiricists are often excited about it and try to understand why it doesn't happen. And vice versa, other empiricist study systems that are seemingly supersaturated with species and have a hard time understanding how these species can be stabilized through niche partitioning, given that little spatial space that they're all in. So, and I wonder if these conditions that are required and necessary for speciation, so let's perhaps not think about purely allopatric speciation at the moment, although we could come back to that, of course, and for coexistence the same, and sort of an extension of that, and that relates to what Andrew has started discussing yesterday, is that that parameter space that might be necessary and sufficient for speciation and coexistence, is that emerging dynamically from the ecological and also the sexual processes, like we heard talk this morning about sexual group formation and coexistence through partitioning of space? Are these parameter spaces sort of dynamically emerging, or are they dictated by the environment?
Hold off till we've heard a few more people, but don't forget, and I won't let you forget, ecological coexistence, speciation, if and only if. Geza, please.
I would like to draw something. Related to this question and answer to Andrew's question yesterday, whether bimodality of the research or the competition, imagine that a very, very bimodal research distribution for the birds, but the birds are limited by a very small number of nests, so we have very small number of birds, and a huge amount of bimodal food. What will this bird will eat? They eat this one, because this is they like this research better, and each bird eat this because this is the better, and none of the birds has a reason to eat the another food. Change the situation such that we have a huge amount of nesting place and a huge amount of birds. No, they try. All of them try to eat the best one, but it is in short supply, so many birds will be selected to eat the another one. So what is matter here is not the bimodality, but the fact that but the structure of regulation. If it is regulated here, then it. But bimodality doesn't matter. If it is regulated here and we have two different niches, then there is niche segregation. Now, back to your question. This biological story, almost identical, if I want to tell this as an issue of coexistence or want to tell as an issue of speciation. In this sense. On the other hand, it will not work as a mathematical theorem saying that if and only if they can coexist, then they will speciate. It is not just simple, because if you imagine a very arbitrary resource distribution and how they will partition into niches is a very complicated issue, and it is not a simple question who will coexist with whom. Eva told us yesterday that he proved in some context that they can choose the trade-off such that such equivalence will be true, but of course the nature not necessarily use that trade-off. So as a mathematical statement, it is not true, but as a biological common sense, I think it is meaningful.
Is going to discuss what happens when eastern gray squirrels invade the Galapagos Islands. Geza, that's wonderful. That connection then between the feedback environment, between the speciation is very appropriate and wonderful.
I'm going to talk a little bit about a sort of philosophical paradox of coexistence and speciation, which I don't think has been talked about, although I think it might be important. Although perhaps it would seem trivial to you. But anyway, I'll try it out. So species concepts actually haven't been talked very much about here. A classical species concept is the biological species concept. Species are reproductively isolated. An alternative species concept would be phenotypic clusters or genotypic clusters. If you can generate a branching event with separate genotypic clusters, then we have separate species. So in the second case, which I believe is more sensible, we have a situation where the reproductive isolation probably is the cause of speciation, but it isn't the definition of speciation. And I've argued in print that this is more sensible. However, both of these species concepts are, in a sense, sensible, and they have their adherents. But neither of them are really carefully defined in allopatry. Now, that's important because it means we really have a rather indefinite idea of the numbers of species across the planet, and we will always have an indefinite idea of that. We can count local genotypic clusters locally, or local reproductively isolated populations locally, but we really can't count them in space. And the reason is that you can take two different species from sympatry or allopatry and put them together in captivity and test whether they're reproductively isolated, but they may interbreed. They may break down their genotypic clusters because, of course, you're not treating them in their natural environment. Their natural environment includes their Grunelian niche, which is where they're distributed in space. So Meyer's species concept breaks down in allopatry, the reproductive isolation mode, and as does the genotypic cluster concept. So this is why the genotypic cluster idea, I think, you know, in Diekmann and Derbele's model of sympatric speciation, it's terribly useful in sympatry, but it doesn't really mean anything in allopatry because any population will diverge in gene frequencies and become a separate genotypic cluster in allopatry. So now that's interesting because if this is true, if this philosophical paradox exists, then it makes allopatric speciation undefinable. In other words, all speciation must almost by definition be in sympatry because we can only define species in sympatry. And I like that, of course, because I think that it's probably a very common mode of speciation, sympatric. But it does make it a bit hard to argue with other people who are convinced that allopatric speciation is the most important kind of speciation. But I do think, on the other hand, the realization of this this problem sort of also focuses our attention to what is really the interesting thing about speciation, which is how you get a build-up of local biodiversity from evolution. We're really not interested in infinitely divisible spatial things that look like species. We're much more interested in whether you can get coexistence locally within a region. So that's what I have to say.
Jim, that's super cool. I think we would all agree that both the statements thrown out by our three motivators, and I'm going to allow them to have the last word on this topic, so I'm going to ask them to remain quiet then as we kind of throw this one out there. But I think we'd agree. Speciation, species coexistence is those of us that love, want to conserve, and understand biodiversity. This is like a core topic. So please, anybody have a thought on any of the three things thrown out there? That speciation, if and only if, Andy's island that's being invaded with eastern gray squirrels. Or this paradox of, and I love that statement, how people are just sitting there. 20 years ago, Bob Holt and I were at a meeting where the statement was, as we now know, sympatric speciation does not happen, and allopatric specie is the only important mode of speciation. Jim just got up there and warmed my heart with sort of an opposite. So, anybody?
So I think that the part of the conflation here that I think is confusing the situation a bit is that the assumption that the coexisting species would have to emerge in sympatry themselves, where if the species do emerge in allopatry but then come back into secondary contact, then you can still assess whether or not they're separate species, even though the speciation event occurred in allopatry. And so the conditions, I think, for coexistence in that kind of scenario, which must be extremely common, that species don't always, all of them, originate in exactly the same place. I mean, many of them are going to originate over here or there and then come back together. That doesn't mean the gene flow is not occurring. So the distinction there, of course, is that you have pre-existing differences before you get back into sympatry, which, of course, aids the process. As a matter of fact, the sympatry then really, really helps through reinforcement, character displacement, things like that. So I think that, for me, I mean, perhaps it's obvious, but it just hadn't been said yet, so I thought I'd state the obvious, that the fundamental distinction between the necessary or sufficient conditions or parameter space for speciation versus species coexistence will be very different, simply because you have pre-existing differences that can be reinforced when species come back into sympatry, but that won't occur during the process of sympatric speciation, which is more common than previously thought, but less common than Jim thinks.
Well, I guess I just kind of want to say I don't really know that any of those terms really exist, sympatry and allopatry. I mean, I can't imagine a situation where every individual in a population has an equal chance of mating with every other individual. So as far as I'm concerned, there's always some space, there's always some limits to recombination somewhere. And similarly with allopatry, if you have two island populations that have been isolated for 1,000 years and then one bird flies between them and their bird populations, does that stop it being allopatric? I mean, the two are just extremes I can't even imagine in nature. So for me, I think the key issue that comes up is how you get associations between alleles. So disequilibria is basically what starts the whole process. It's when you can start to get selection on the combined effects of genes. I mean, obviously, we know that epistasis is very common and exists all the time, but if one mutation spreads to fixation before another one arises, then epistasis doesn't have an effect. And this is kind of what Fisher's point about additive fitness comes in. It's that an allele sinks or swims based on its effects over many different backgrounds of other genes. But once you get associations between genes, for whatever reason, and I think that's one of the key parts of speciation theory, is understanding where this equilibrium comes from, and once it arises, how easily can it be selected for? How easily can different types of disequilibria become associated together? And then you start to get selection to reduce dispersal or mate assortatively or habitat preference. But the whole idea of the geographical mode of speciation to me seems, I mean, it's a nice way of thinking, but I don't think it has much reality. And another level, every locus in a genome has a potentially different history if you're a sexual organism. So some genes may have diverged in the same population, some genes may have diverged thousands of miles apart. You know, when you, as Andrew says, when populations meet, like in hybrid zones, some of those genes may have never seen each other before. Others may have been bedfellows for several hundred years or thousand generations. So to me, sexual organisms are mosaics of genes, each with independent histories, potentially independent histories. And I think we have to be careful not to get driven down this allopatric versus sympatric division. I think that's what I'm saying.
So in a sense, we had Ole kind of pointing out how ecological opportunity may make speciation demand-driven, and you're almost suggesting that from the point of view of resurrecting the additive genetic variants is actually whether it's actually genetically supply-driven. That's kind of cool. So any additional thoughts on... Well, I am going to ask, can the two people that gave talks on the neutral model of speciation... You put up your hands. That was so cool. I'd really like if you're willing to, to say where you see your research program and what you're doing fitting with the other things that are going on, how you think we can be, or those that are here that do evolutionary branching can be useful to you, and what you would like these other people to take home from what you are doing.
Okay, as I said during the talk, I'm rather an outsider to this field, so I have no precise ideas. Anyway, for what I could understand up to now, my impression is that essentially trying to put more realistic speciation mechanism in this natural framework would be surely one of the most interesting things to do, to see how far this kind of approach can bring in reproducing some patterns or statistical data that we observe empirically. And of course, another point which would be interesting is to perturb somehow neutrality, to see if you get away completely in another direction, which is telling you that somehow is you are unstable if you're neutral, or if the patterns are more or less well reproduced as well also when you perturb a little bit neutrality. That would mean that even if neutrality is maybe simply an abstract way of looking at things, anyway, it's still able to catch somehow some property of the system you are studying.
So as I already said during my talk, I'm not working on neutral theory, so I cannot really answer your question. So, but maybe there's one point worth making, which I kind of forgot to say in the talk. That is, so what I think the one of the things that is really useful in this neutral theory, and which is maybe also kind of interesting to consider in this kind of workshop, is just the idea of stochasticity and transient dynamics and things like that, because it, like especially yesterday afternoon in this discussion on continuous coexistence, yes or no, it kind of struck me that all these arguments are in a very, very extremely deterministic framework and are dealing with very, very long-term equilibria. And so as a kind of an antidote to this, it might be useful to sometimes consider that actually there's lots of stochasticity in nature. And yeah, maybe as another point of view is in this model in this sexual model that I presented, in this paper by De Aguiar, where speciation happens due to local dispersal and some kind of sexual selection, you get these spatial clusters. That's exactly the model that Rupert Matsuko also studied. And he asked then, okay, what can we do to stabilize these clusters? Whereas in the model I looked at, actually, and I had planned to say this, but I forgot, we're not, the authors of this paper did not ask how these clusters can be stabilized, because they were not stable. There was a continuous turnover of, if you want, competitive exclusion happening, so one of these clusters would disappear, but then a new one would pop up because mutations were going on, and so there's just this continuous turnover, and then at just some point in time, we just take a snapshot and look at what the community looks like right now, and from this, then you can then derive these patterns, and it's, so sometimes you don't need to worry about indefinite coexistence, maybe.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, before I give this back to
Yeah, we'd just like to add a few points on that. Michael also already mentioned this morning that neutral theory, there's some elements in neutral theory that I think are very useful for just development of thinking. That's the stochasticity, it's dispersal, but also this idea of that's the sampling theory. So neutral theory applies to samples. And so it gets much closer, to me at least, to the empirical people, because it actually says, well, I'm trying to say something about samples, about your data, not about just communities in general. And there's a totally different thing, and it has helped us, at least me, to think about, you know, the whole sampling process and how that actually influences how what inferences we can make. The other comment I wanted to make is that what I found funny, just looking back at how, you know, how things worked, is that so the model that I presented this morning wasn't considered a neutral model because it doesn't consider individuals, and so it has been around, I think, since the 70s with Raup and Stanley and people like that who introduced this birth death model, and it didn't. As far as I remember, well, I was hardly born then, but. It didn't meet as much resistance as did the neutral theory of biodiversity that Hubble put in his book. And in fact, you could argue that Hubble's theory is more realistic, but because it considers individuals. So I find it just that sort of a paradox of how things work in science, that all of a sudden, when you make a theory more realistic, people are arguing, against it. So. Maybe sometimes you need to make your theory less realistic, and then you don't have a problem.
You just solved a lot of my problems. Thanks. That. Any other thoughts on that before I give it to our motivators for their last comment on this topic, and we'll move on. So please.
Thank you, John. I've been trying to listen to you and trying to see if I can condense an answer to my question from the various things. I'm not sure I'm able to, but it seems to me it's very, I mean, it's from all of what we have been hearing and what you have been saying now, it's quite clear that these conditions are not always the same. And it's also seemingly quite clear that perhaps the predictions of sort of like adaptive dynamics models would be met in many cases where the ecological conditions and the genetic requirements would both come sort of coincide at the right point and place and time. And perhaps the question is, how often has that happened? And as empiricists, of course, we're often dealing with trying to understand why one group of organisms multiplies and proliferates incredibly much, whereas another one is extremely conservative and seems to fail to respond to any opportunity that environment gives it. And so perhaps would it help us to think about this a little bit more, or develop a slightly more quantitative, perhaps, a conceptual framework to ask, do these systems that differ in their rates of diversification, perhaps for some reason, differ in how frequently these conditions sort of coincide in space and time, like the ecological and genetic conditions? I don't know if that's not, I'm sure it's not an answer, but perhaps it's one direction that we could try to go a little further.
Somebody just wants to get in.
When you talk about a failure to radiate, do you mean, I mean, I wonder whether that's really a failure, because I could argue, I mean, if you radiate, that means that you're split up in a specific species. But what if you don't do that, but you're just plastic enough or whatever, you're a generalist, isn't that good enough as well? I mean, it's not as nice maybe as seeing all these different species, but ecologically, it might be just the same thing.
No, of course. When I say failure, I didn't mean it in any. So it's not a failure in the sense that it's bad to not speciate. Just in the sense of we're trying to understand the differences between lineages and how much they speciate. Call it failure or not, I don't know. Call it success if you can occupy all habitats without speciating. I don't care. But beyond that, there's another argument that is that many species fail any of these. If they neither occupy available energy and resources through speciating, nor through adapting in any other way, or through acquiring plasticity. So, oh yes, John has an answer to this.
As always, I just wanted to ask. Actually, I always talk to my undergraduates about whether specialization is a dead end. So, it's connecting with what you were saying about generalists is a really good strategy. You get a huge population. You're very resistant to extinction, you're quite plastic, you're able to evolve very quickly and match a gradient that's changing in space and time. But how many examples do we know of organisms that have become specialized and then gone back to being generalized again? Is speciation like a one-way street? The niches get narrow and then stay narrow. I can think of only a couple of examples where species have gone back to being generalist. I'm thinking of like switch plants where they lost leaves and then went back and they've got leaves come, you know, they make their stems get flattened again to make leaves because they come back out into dark environments. It's very common in plants.
From this explanation to repollination, become generalist.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so I mean, I think that's quite an important issue, is whether or not specialisation is a one-way street, and getting lots of cichlid species, I mean, they also have a very high extinction rate. So those genomes are pretty fragile, you know, in the long term.
So when I said that I think it is a meaningful biological intuition that a possibility of coexistence roughly corresponds to the drive toward the speciation, I meant for the case when the organism itself has the propensity to do this, because if there is no any mechanism which can distinguish between them, then we still speciation could be advantageous, but it will not happen, as nothing happened in evolution, which is impossible.
Okay, well, I'm not going to answer everybody's points, but first of all, I'd like to address this issue of whether allopatry and sympatry are meaningful distinctions. And of course, actually, can I have a pen? Yeah. If I just draw it here, that's the famous Gavrilets diagram. He likes very simple things. And this is M, and if it's 0.5, and zero. This is M is migration rate. If it's 0.5, you have sympatry, and if it's zero, you have allopatry. And he argues, therefore, basically everything is parapatric. And Coyne and Orr then used this as part of their argument to say that basically sympatric speciation is very unlikely. But in fact, they were changing the argument by changing that definition and using Gavrilets' definition. So I don't think that's a very sensible definition. But what we can say is, we go out and we sample a population, we can actually find they're approximately in Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium at a particular spatial scale, which I will call sympatry. And I think we have the same sort of argument for allopatry. So by allopatry, I mean approximate allopatry, and by sympatry, I mean approximate sympatry. Okay, so that's out of the way. the next thing is, I think Andrew in particular, I'd like to address his point. Of course, there is allopatric divergence, but what I'm arguing is that it isn't speciation until you come back into sympatry, and that's a slight paradox. Perhaps you don't think it's important, and I think Andrew does not think it's important. But he then mentioned reinforcement, which I think we all agree could be important, because that's essentially a sympatric speciation process. So now I think what is an interesting question is, what is the relative contribution of allopatry and sympatry to speciation? And that's an interesting question, because essentially it seems to me that coexistence is unlikely to evolve in allopatry. Now, I've phrased that deliberately paradoxically, because what I mean really, though, is that the coexistence possibility is unlikely to be designed correctly in allopatry. But as soon as sympatry comes along, then the selective processes will take over to permit or not to permit sympatry. So now this means that coexistence possibility being defined as speciation, which I think it is in both the biological species concept and in the genotypic cluster argument. It's an interesting question as to know how much of it is actually happening in allopatry, which would be essentially a neutral model of speciation, right? Because it is not designed to allow coexistence. Versus in sympatry, in which case it is being designed to allow coexistence. So I think that is a question, and I actually don't think we know the answer. I think it's a very interesting question. We know that, for instance, surveys of Drosophila, it looks like there's really good comparative evidence for reinforcement, which suggests that sympatric processes are extremely important in speciation, if that's true. So I'll leave it there.
That was cool. I
Thanks. That summed it up. That summed it up very, very nicely. And actually, we got a couple of thoughts coming up. I'm going to let you get back, kind of last word, because Ola's going to have to leave. But there's.
Okay, just one comment on what we just heard about allopatric symmetry. First of all, one has to remember that these are patterns and really not processes. Allopatric and symmetry, they can even evolve. I mean, the M parameter there can be subject to evolution as well and gradually change during a speciation process. And allopatry as a pattern might appear since the few individuals that do disperse between habitats are actually immediately outcompeted by the locally already adapted morph or species or whatever it is that actually occurs in that habitat already. So we have to be a little bit careful about these concepts as if they and not really think of them as sort of imposed from the outside. They are part of the process in a way and patterns.
I just wanted to add to what Jim said. I think that it wouldn't it be ironical if it turns out in the end that perhaps allopatry is needed for sympatric speciation? It seems to me that's not so unlikely because what seemingly happens, I agree with Jim that allopatry doesn't select for coexistence, but allopatry allows for divergence. And once you're fairly divergent, it's easier for divergent selection in sympatry to select for coexistence. And in fact, it has turned out in quite a few cases of these rapid adaptive and most impressive adaptive radiations like the cichlid fish in African lakes and some other fish radiations, that they're not monophyletic, as people have thought until very recently, but that they've often been seeded by multiple very divergent, very unrelated lineages that have indeed come back after secondary contact and have not necessarily just been reinforced as they were, but they have admixed their partially linked genes. And it is that situation that makes what John was talking about much easier, namely selection can start working right away on genotypes rather than alleles. And that would be, I think, it would be quite ironic if we come to that.
That is a cool and provocative point.
Okay, so the question is how divergence arises, and of course I would argue that it should arise also in sympatry, or mainly in sympatry, or that. So what you asked at the very beginning, whether this is an emerging process or something outside from the system should induce. And unfortunately, we didn't have a microbiologist here who would tell us this cross-feeding story where you have a coli, and this coli get glucose, and the coli produces glycerol and ethanol. And then repeatedly, if you repeat this experiment several times, if you wait enough time, you have three bacteria clones living together without any effect from outside, because the bacteria itself provided three resources instead of the single one what is given from outside. Okay, so because the coexistence is possible, because instead of the single regulating factor, the glucose what we gave to the system, already three is there, and then in the same proportion, repeatedly, you will have three clones. Okay, and coexistence of three clones. And it is the only way to explain this is competition.
Don't shake the line.
Okay, with that, we have a wonderful segue. Please, Liz, don't sit down. Stay right where you are. Absolutely. Hold on, but just stay right here.
Okay, I was just listening to this whole discussion more on the side as a taxonomist, although I showed something else today here. But when you look at the pattern of biodiversity, and you look at taxonomical results, especially phylogeny, you very often find that the discovery or the recovery of the phylogeny of certain groups very often is related to some kind of geological events. And very often you find that there is a parapatric or allopatric speciation, because it can be related to some kind of geological event that separates groups. So basically we talk about vicariants. So, but there are some other places which are more stable, let's say geologically more calm, and then you see adaptive radiation there, maybe because the area is more diverse and gives more place for niches. And then the diversification is related to that. And maybe sympatric speciation has more a role in those calm areas. But when there are areas where there is a really turnover, a geological unrestness, and then you see the diversification there, then easily you can think of allopatric speciation. So basically, if you look at the pattern and you look at maybe the results, some can do a kind of meta-analysis of the results of the in the literature and see there are speciations and diversifications in calm areas, but maybe diverse areas, and where there are specifications or speciations in much less calm areas, where geology may play a role in diversification.
So this is what we need, actually. We need this graph, right? And then we need distributions of speciational events on that graph. Now, okay, so M0 to 0.5. This is what we want to know, right? Moreover, if it changes through time, which we think, what we want is time over here and M like this, and then the courses of all of those speciation events, where they went up like that or whatever. That's ultimately what we're striving for when we ask about what's important with respect to gene flow and speciation. And hopefully we could all strive for that or convince our industrious colleagues to do so.
Andy, that's cool. Yep.
I have a point I forgot to mention, that Nick Barton is not here, and that's a pity, because he would raise the point that I think that what all the people here, from Bob through the adaptive dynamic people through the population geneticists, will agree that it's much easier to speciate with less dispersal. So if you are in a sympatric population and if you are completely isolated, these are both not that good as a parapatric speciation, where you have a certain amount of dispersal. If it is too high, then it will reduce the possibilities. If it is too low, again, will reduce the possibilities. So people see so many speciation along special gradients or between habitats. This is all together because there is already a sort of reduction in dispersal.
Thank you. So I think it's true. You need some space. You have to have some space to generate the differentiation. But I agree with what Early was saying, that it basically gene flow actually makes speciation more likely because it generates disequilibria. So I think complete allopatry, as Jim says, is very, very hard to generate speciation. So I think I'd sort of say that actually, you know, it's all about how you generate these associations between genes, and that's the really important thing. I wanted to make just a point about transient dynamics, if I could, because we've been thinking about transient dynamics in terms of ecology, and that's really, really important. And, you know, increasingly, more simulations I do, the more I realize that. But the world of genetics, genomics, is in turmoil as well because of transient dynamics, because the recent studies of genome-wide association studies have shown that heritability estimates based on knowing the parents of individuals are much, much better at determining heritability, at explaining heritability, than thousands and thousands of genes screened for individuals. So the genome-wide association studies explain hardly any of the heritability that we know is existing in natural populations, like in humans. And there's sort of two explanations for that. And one of the most sort of terrifying for geneticists is the fact that it could be very, very rare alleles, which have huge effects on phenotypes in populations. And that means that these alleles can very transiently appear and disappear and become fixed in populations, and they're very hard to predict what's going to happen. Similarly, a lot of that variation, or the other explanation, is that a lot of that variation, that heritability, could be down to very transient associations between alleles that crop up only in a few individuals in a population. So I think transient dynamics are going to become increasingly important, potentially in genetics as well as in ecology, because the models we use for genetics are actually often based on lots of loci with intermediate allele frequencies rather than just many loci fixed and a few novel mutations that are having a big effect on phenotypic variation. So look out for sort of transient dynamics coming into genetics as well and making everything horribly, horribly complicated.
Well, I'm first going to just thank our motivators. I think they did their job. They motivated, so thank you. That. And I particularly want to say thanks because as somebody who has been listening to these discussions, I'm afraid to say, for 30 years, what is really wonderful is, of course, certain topics have remained unresolved and continue to be out there. But in listening to this discussion and thinking back to taking speciation 30 years ago, there is a lot of new under the sun, and I really appreciate that and congratulate everybody in the discussion. We are now that they've speciated, whether allopatrically, sympatrically, parapatrically, somewhere along that M, they, of course, have to have a niche to be able to persist. And so where would our discussion not be if we did not take the pieces of niches, as I blatantly, without attribution, still steal somebody's term? So let us please.
So I would like to know your opinion and discuss the relation of the Hutchinsonian and Gaussian niche. Because obviously they seem to be different concepts. And the question is whether they are really different or not. And what if there is a difference, what is the difference? And let's start from that statement that distribution and abundance is the topic of ecology. Moreover, in 2002, the Royal Society had a meeting where they said that the population growth rate is the central variable of ecology. I was very happy when I realized that this was made because I deeply agree with this thing. Okay, so we have the population growth rate, and this population growth rate is measured in ecology in several situations. And the intrinsic rate of increase, that is the rate of increase at low population density, this is R naught, This is the basis for the Hutchinsonian niche concept. So we look for the conditions where this R naught is higher than zero. It is usually done in that way that we look at temperature, humidity, salinity, pH. So-called conditional. Environmental conditions which are not regulating factors. When people do it in the lab, they provide a good amount of food for their organisms when they decide that these tolerance functions, that when they measure these tolerance functions. And so they just include a subset of the environmental variables, and these are the non-regulating environmental variables because they exclude parasites, exclude predators, and give lots of food. Okay, under these conditions, the ecological tolerance in relation to the non-regulating variables can be measured. Okay, let's continue on with the concept and say that of course we want to know which are those food levels where the species where a population may survive, and then just remember Tillman and his R star. And then, of course, it very much depends on what is the loss rate, so whether a parasite or a predator is also included into the system. So, conceptually, if you make an experiment where you put in all the players which are relevant in relation to your species, to your population, and you want to, because you want to know its distribution in nature, Then, of course, you will get the niche of this population, okay? Because you will know that at which temperature, at which food level, at what predator density this species will survive, because it has a a positive R naught, then it will have a population, okay, maintained. So if you include everything, then you get a Gaussian niche in that sense, that that it will be species specific. The only problem is that first of all, it is forgotten many times that the niche concept originally was something unique for each species. That's what I argue, that I didn't get back reactions whether you agree or not. So trophic niche and climatic niche and so on. So it somehow erodes the concept. But if it is the situation, we have to accept and somehow cope with it. And then this is the first part of my argument. The second part concerns the Gaussian niche. I mentioned that, for instance, when we made a textbook about ecology and discussed and introduced the Lotka-Volterra competition models, then it was made in terms of initial rate of increase argument. So you just look at the competing species and say that in the population of the other species, their initial rate of increase, that is their R naught, will be positive or not. And if both of them have positive R naught in the other's population, so there is rare advantage, there is frequency dependence, and there is coexistence. Okay? And then in this way, we handle competition completely in terms of frequency dependence and R naught. Okay. So, When we argue that when you make a speciation study and it should be when at the very very beginning it should be decided that what may regulate this population, these populations which are under the study of adaptive divergence, because then I shall understand my fitness functions in relative terms as well. So this is the only thing what we argue about. And the third point I should make is to point to the fact that I will not make the third point.
Well, right off the bat, you heard the question. To be or are not to be? Does anybody want... Bob, would you still rescue me and say a few words?
I have what amount to some sort of free associations on what Liz said and on some of the previous comments. I actually think there's a blurring of the Hutchinsonian and Gaussian niches, that there's not a clean distinction between those ideas. I mean, the cleaner distinction comes from specifying what you need to increase when rare, and then understanding the impact species have on the environment, which includes regulation of themselves and non-regulatory effects via impacts on other species. A couple of the speakers, I mean, the Lotka-Volterra model came up frequently, and I can't remember who pointed out that, you know, if you're at equilibrium, you can always create a model, regardless how nonlinear the basic model of community is, that's Lotka-Volterra in form when you look at the effects of small perturbations in numbers. The problem is that if you're interested in biogeography and the history of communities, species invade and then increase when rare relative to all the abundances of the species that are present, which include massive nonlinearities in the world that you can't average over by assuming a Lotka-Volterra model. I've been thinking as we've gone through this meeting about kind of what are some of the current currents in community ecology that are sort of, we haven't really dealt with. And I'll just mention a couple of these. One is, I've not really heard anybody talk very much about pathogens and parasites as really significant key modes of density-dependent population regulation and interactions among species. And so, Jim, I think you were saying that you can't imagine a mechanism whereby you have allopatry between two populations, and you put them back together, and you've got a mechanism of coexistence. Well, I can if you imagine the coevolutionary arms race is constantly taking place between hosts and their pathogens and parasites, which if they diverge sufficiently enough so the parasites don't recognize the other hosts when they come back together, species bring in with them their own density-dependent regulation. I think that's a very important thing. You know, and the question is, how much of the world do you have to... Okay, I've got a couple other thoughts. Here we've got this axis, and I agree with Andrew completely that understanding where the world sits along here, this would be a very cool thing to figure out. But what determines M in the first place? You know, M is movement. Movement, you know, it's not like conservation of mass. It's not forced on organisms to move at a certain rate. Organisms move for good reasons, on average, one presumes. So we're talking about the evolution dispersal, right? And that leads to two things. One is organisms tend to disperse because the world is temporally variable as well as spatially variable. So, oh, I did. I'm going to get back to that.
Okay, very good.
So I'll need that. So I think we really need to, you know, and, you know, talking about long-term equilibrium and models where there's spatial heterogeneity, but there's no temporal variability. I just wonder how much of reality we're leaving out, because there's a lot of temporal variability in the world. I mean, maybe the reason Ole's small lakes don't have an adaptive radiation is they occasionally dry out, and so they get recolonized, and so there's huge variability in the environment's organisms experience. You know, when I think about community ecology, you know, so I'm not thinking as an evolutionary biologist here just about what people are talking about these days. So let's think about competitive interactions between two consumers going after two resources, okay? And they have some partial overlap in their diet. So each one's attacking their own resource at a certain rate, and at a lesser rate, the other one's resource. So that looks like a classical model of competition, okay? However, I can easily, without changing the species at all, I can easily turn it into a model of mutualism between the species from an ecological point of view by imagining that, say, these are plants, these are herbivores in the plants, and the plants actually compete directly for resources. They compete for light, they compete for nitrogen or whatever. So that ecologically, even though these species appear to be mutualist in terms of their overlap in diet, if this competition is strong enough, if you take this species out, this resource goes up, it knocks this preferred resource down, and this species actually goes down. So by changing something somewhere else in the community, you change the feedback structure, so you go from a competitive interaction to a mutualistic interaction. Okay? How important is that for topics like adaptive radiation? I don't think we actually know. So let's see. What were some other thoughts that I had? So there's issues. So the other thing about space is that the other reason organisms move around in space is because they extract resources from the environment. There are a lot of specialist lifestyles that require you to move in space, okay? So one way you get coexistence of species in a community is you have some things that are very sedentary, that are using just local resources, and others that are going around getting bits of their niche picked up here and there from the landscape to stitch their niche together in a certain sense. Another thing that's been left out that's really significant in community ecology at present, but I haven't heard anything about it here, is that species aren't homogeneous ecologically, even leaving aside genetics. They have stage structure, they have age structure, they have all kinds of internal heterogeneities and differences among sex and differences among individual experiences, and all that matters. André de Roos in Amsterdam and Leonard Pearson up at UMIA have done some very cool studies where they look at fish that you think would be competing, but because of the fish are divided into juveniles and adults and there's density dependence, actually the fish can be mutualist, okay, in the same lake because of the shifts in the stage structure that go about because the other species is present. Again, you know, how important is that for adaptive radiations? I have no idea, but it's certainly something that's important in how communities are organized that people are paying a lot of attention to now. The other thing, and I agree totally with Liz, something you said a few minutes ago. I mean, you know, were we to have this conference 5 years or 10 years from now, I would hope we'd have a lot of people who are doing, who are working with microbes who are here, because that is, you know, half the biomass of the planet after all. And it's one place you can do experiments on adaptive radiations. Okay, so people like Travisano have found, you know, space really matters. You mix things up, you get some adaptive radiation of the sort you're talking about, but you have many fewer species arise, and when you allow them, when you don't mix it up, so you've got things forming on the walls, thing high up in the beaker, low down in the beaker, and so forth. So those are just some thoughts.
I know Liz has some thoughts, and we're going to make sure we get them, but let's get it. Yeah, but...
So that I just want to say that last point about individuals not being all the same within a species. So I haven't read the paper recently, but there's a science paper by Clark, right? I don't know. It doesn't seem like that many people have seen it, but they argued specifically in there and provided a mechanism whereby variation among individuals within species, if that was large, that was the primary mechanism of species coexistence. So I haven't heard a single word about that at this meeting, which kind of surprised me.
Mitches, anybody? Mitches?
If you open the book of Hutchinson at the chapter niche, the very first word you see in this chapter is Gaussian. And then he explained the Gaussian principle, the history of it, and so on. And it's very obvious in the chapter that he meant Hutchinson meant the Hutchinsonian niche as a more precise formulation of the Gaussian principle. He even introduced the alpha and beta niche with a different terminology. Somewhere much later, nowadays, if you open an ecology book at the figure out what is Hutchinsonian niche, it often has nothing to do with the Gauss's principle. It only beta, and it is only the distribution of the species. So something was lost, and it's my hypothesis. I'm interested in your opinion. Is that what was lost is the loss of faith in the Gauss's principle during the 80s? People started to think that. The words are much more complicated than Hutchinson assumed, and then the beta distribution interpretation of Hutchinson could survive in this environment, but the original intent is not. This is my reading.
Feeling a niche, feeling a thought? Out there? Well, you know, that's okay. I'm going to ask Liz to give us some thoughts, and Bob, we'll get sort of a few more thoughts. And...
Okay, I know my third point.
This is like the Liz and Bob show, you know, we're going to make it a serial.
Is this a comedy or
a just a play. So
I wanted to conclude in that way, that we agree on that. What is so? Start what we agree on. That we agree on that what is really important are the conditions which make coexistence possible, which means that which make possible that two forms. The initial increase of two forms would be positive when they are together. Okay. Which means that one can give the conditions for coexistence in terms of regulating factors. Lotka Volterra is not interesting here because you are right that linearity is a very narrow assumption, but the whole thing works for non-linearity as well. But what is important that you can give the you can give the conditions for coexistence in terms of regulating factors in that way, that if they are regulated with different factors, then they will coexist. If they share some regulating factors, they will coexist robustly if the impact and sensitivity is the difference between impact and sensitivity is large enough. And then, of course, but when you say that parasite, prey, and so on, that these are the regulating factors. We are just talking about the same things, and thinking in the regulating factors, what they call environmental feedbacks, and the variables which are in the environmental feedbacks. We are just talking about the very same thing. I thought that to formalize all this within the population regulation paradigm is just help to connect the various levels. So the single population dynamics, multiple community dynamics, and so on.
If I could, we'll think about it. Yes, of course.
No, it's very quick. So the thing about Locke-Volterra surely is if you add more species, you get more variables. You know, every species has some two or three new variables. So isn't that enough non-linearity for you as an approximation?
No. I want to respond to, you know, thinking about another thing that, but this is responding to what Liz did, and I'm going to go back a bit in history here. And Liz had actually asked me to think more formally about the history of the niche concept and so forth, and I'm not going to do that because that's a large task. But if you go back to 1970, the last substantial paper that Robert MacArthur wrote was the first paper that appeared in the journal Theoretical Population Biology. And what he did in that paper was he came up with a mechanistic way of framing the Locke-Volterra model of competition in terms of the mechanisms of interactions between consumers and their resources. And you can express that, the basic idea, the model graphically, and it illustrates something that complements what you said, okay, that says there's more than one thing to think about when you think about coexistence. So remember I had this picture up here. I'm assuming the resources are not competing with each other, okay, but the consumers can overlap. Okay, so the simplest model is to assume that you've got and that's all that's going on. The consumers don't directly interfere with each other or whatever. So each consumer then can have an isocline, a combination of resources, outside of which it grows from an error and within which it can persist. So we can draw, you know, for consumer two, maybe that's its isocline. For consumer one, that's its isocline. So Tillman's R star for resource one is right there, and this is kind of a community R star, if you will. Okay, so if you're going to get coexistence, it would be right here. Okay, well, two things. One is whether or not you can actually get there from the resource states depends upon the impacts, you know, whether or not you can regulate it or not. The second is, though, that so niche differentiation is necessary for coexistence, but I could have also drawn these like, I don't know, this or something. So there are differences between species, but they don't actually overlap. So in order for them to cross, they have to be similar. And so this, you know, what determines this R star isn't just resources, it's what your death rate is, for instance, in a particular abiotic environment. So you change the abiotic environment, you change the temperature, and you can go from here to here. So the kind of the non-regulatory factors help influence whether or not species are similar enough in respect to their general response to the environment that then the niche differences between them in terms of resource use can permit their coexistence. And that's what Peter Chesson calls equalizing mechanisms versus stabilizing mechanisms in coexistence. And so that's another dimension here where the things like the Hutchinsonian niche kind of kick in species responses to temperature and pH and osmotic stuff in the water and so forth. All is in the background when you're talking about niche differentiation because it's a requirement. Both are necessary. and sufficient for coexistence. You have to think about both the factors that allow stabilization, i.e. distinctions in regulation, but also how they respond in general to the environment, which is everything that limits their numbers, not just what leads to density-dependent feedbacks.
Okay, I have a question, because we don't understand this equalizing mechanism, whether there is a mechanism for equalization. Because but simply it may mean that those species which have similar ecological tolerances may live in the same habitat. Okay, so, but it doesn't mean that there is any mechanisms which make more similar the intrinsic rate of increase of the species to each other. No, we don't know about it. If you, then just explain us if there is any mechanism, because of course they have to live in the very same physical environment, so their environmental tolerances must overlap at least.
Well, it might be that they're similar in their body size, they're similar in their basic physiology, there are lots of axes. You could look at morphometric similarity among organisms, and the more similar they are with respect to all the things you can measure about, the more likely they're going to respond in similar ways to many factors in the environment, other than just the factors that are actually regulating their number in the sense of leading to density-dependent feedbacks that may be specialized or not. So I could go from a picture like this to a picture like this by changing the body size of one of them, for instance. So there are lots of organismal traits that influence whether or not they're similar enough to allow these niche differences to kick in. Now, whether or not you want to call them mechanisms or not is a matter of semantics from my point of view. There are factors at play that influence whether or not they can coexist.
One connection I would like to make: if you change the R note of one of the species, you move this line in this direction, and if you move too much, there will be no crossing and end up this one. Now the question is how much you are allowed to move it, and it depends on the angle between this. So obviously, it is almost parallel, then it a very a small movement will go out of the allowed range, you can imagine. And this vector and this vector, which I call the sensitivity vector, which should be different, which means this angle should be large enough. Now, back to the equalizing mechanism, of course, you are right that there are many parameters which makes this R note sufficiently similar in a given environment allowing to coexist. Now, the problem is that many ecologists assume that there are some special ecological conditions, are environmental fluctuations and such kind of things which tend to equalizing. And this is what is wrong. Of course, these parameters depends everything. So if you change the parameters, you may decrease the difference. But there is no such thing as the disturbance, for instance, decrease the make the parameters of the species more similar. And I think this is an important point which...
Well, we're going to make sure that the Liz and Bob show keeps going. Our ratings are going through the ceiling. But we do have a walk-on guest that we have occasionally each week to keep the show interesting. So please help me welcome Jürgen Ripa as the kindly neighbor next door.
Thank you, Joel. It's so great to be here. I want to thank my mom and dad. No. actually, I just want to throw this out. We keep discussing the niche concept, or is it niche concept? I can't really make up my mind. Is it only me that notices this discrepancy between the theory and the theory? somehow that if you look at all the models that we have discussed lately, some of the models underlying the graphs on here, the niche concept is not in there. We have a trade space, we have sensitivities to feedback environments and so on, but unless you define the niche as simply a point in trade space, I don't see the niche concept in there. You might want to define the niche that way, but that would be fine with me. But my question is, then, do we really need a niche concept? Or can we just forget about it and talk about traits instead?
Okay, I had several arguments why you cannot avoid the niche concept. For 10 years ago, I would have completely agreed with you. I told my students that the niche concept is like a car on the streets of New Delhi. It's completely useless. So. That was my opinion. But then we worked so...
That's the cow.
So we But then I realized that it belongs to the... because we worked together with Geza so much, that of course, for ecology, the question of coexistence is the crucial question. That what makes so many species coexist. And this is... of course, related to the topic of this workshop, that how this diversity arise. Unfortunately, Ole went away because these are very, very closely related questions. I was astonished when I realized that in a logically very consistent way, based on first principles, only on a very few principles, actually on three, Darwin was able to build up a structure which is coincide the present structure of community ecology and population dynamics. And then I thought that, okay, if someone who without any mathematical background was able to just using his logic was able to build up such a system, then it must be very, very robust. And after 150 years of the origin, we are about to understand what he had in mind. And because I think that this is different what the modern synthesis had in mind. The modern synthesis just thought in optimization in a way. Sorry for the population geneticist. It just means that adaptive landscapes, rigid adaptive landscapes, and we are climbing up and so on. But diversification was completely missing. And then... but for Darwin, diversification was important. I was speaking.
Jorgen, I think if you don't have the niche concept, you'll have the same concept and just use a different word. I still think, you know, in my talk I said, you know, you've got the adaptive landscape, which is can be modified to include, you know, for a given frequency of... for a given composition of the population and given abundance, what is, you know, fitness is a function of traits, right? So there's your trait space. But you're still going to have, so I was saying, you still need to know how fitness of a trait varies as a function of the environmental variables. And you're going to still need that concept somehow. And so having the word niche is a very useful way of describing that. And then realizing that in order to build a coexistence, you have to deal with population regulation, which was... less obvious. If you go back to Hutchinson and so forth, he doesn't really talk that much about population regulation. But MacArthur did, actually. If you go back to his 1958, you know, famous paper on the wood warblers in Maine, you know, before he got into the community ecology, he talked about density dependence. And he looked at time series of data. And, you know, one could quibble with, did he actually demonstrate the point he thought he was making? But he said, look, you know, it looks like per capita growth rate goes down when numbers go up. So you've got density dependence, and that's what you need to get competitive interactions, and therefore you need, you know, you've got Gauss's problem of how you get these seemingly similar warblers to coexist. So from the 50s on, the sort of the duality of what organisms need and what their density-dependent feedbacks are on the environment, I think we're there implicitly in community ecology. And I think the word niche is very useful for capturing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I kind of agree that it's kind of useful as a metaphor for a lot of things. But still, I don't think we should take the concept as such too seriously, as if we actually can measure the niche, or as if actually it is something that we should 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 parameterize somehow in the model. In the model, we put we have all these. As I said earlier, we have trade space, we have the feedback environments, and so on. The some sort of niche concept might emanate from that, but it's kind of vague, kind of abstract. And I think if we still want to use it, we should leave it at that. It's kind of vague and kind of abstract.
Listening to Jim Allard, I think that it's no better, no worse than species. Then.
Okay, I think that when you set up your model, you already decide what will be your regulating variables. That's it. And then if you decide what will be your regulating variables, you set up the niche space. Okay. And if your regulating variable is continuous, then it can be divided by many environmental conditions. Like if you are in space, then by temperature, by humidity, and so on.
And as we go into our second season with Sky High Ratings, we have another guest visitor to our show.
I just want to support Jürgen because I am very much in favor of ditching the niche, or dishing the niche, I don't know. And the reason is, I've been discussing this yesterday with Michael and Joachim, and so I think the very reason why people want to keep the niche is actually why we should ditch it, because it seems like a word that we use so that we think that we understand each other, but we don't, and that's actually the reason to ditch it, because we are talking about different things. It's a vague concept, so science is about making things. It is vague. You said it yourself. People have different definitions. So if you have a different definition, use that definition. So science is about making things more specific rather than keeping this kind of a vague concept just for the sake of being able to communicate. Or if you weren't able to communicate, if you're not able to communicate without this niche concept, then this communication isn't really much, you know, isn't really much. So.
No.
What I try to say in my lecture that if you think in the potential regulating factors, then you have a view that how a species can specialize or segregate within a genus. One of the examples was this echolocation example, where prey size was determined by the frequency of the sound, and this is a physical thing. And the way it can be changed determine those size ranges which may provide rooms, niches, for the species, which make them coexist at a certain place. So if we want to make predictions that within a genus, what kind of new species may arise, then the niche concept is there. And if we think in regulation, then these naturally come. And the other thing that, yes, I said that people use the niche in very different ways, but it can be formalized, and please read our 2006 paper in GTB, and there is a non-linear, very general theory behind all this.
One could argue that with these models of diversification that actually there's some implicit niche ideas, such as sort of a carrying capacity for the number of taxa you get in a lineage with birth-death processes. And I was thinking, what determines that? You know, I mean, why isn't it some kind of summation over a lot of lineages, all of that are interacting, just like predators and their prey and the parasites and the resource base, you know? So, again, I think if you don't use the word niche, you're going to be using words that do the same thing, which is okay, as long as one's clear. Yeah.
Right. I agree. Okay.
I think they deserve a round of applause. I want you to know this was done unrehearsed and in front of a live audience. Now, we are going to have one more thing, and usually the moderator is supposed to stay out of it, but just so you know where your moderator's mind is going, if you look at this particular graph, up on this area can be maltose, sugar. This axis is alcohol-free space, and this represents what happens when you brew beer using an ale yeast and a lager yeast together. So you can actually use this theory that Bob put up here to, in fact, prove why you never brew beer with two different yeasts. But that's not to let you know where my mind is already drifting to, but what is really neat is we've had a chance to, of course, listen and hear all of these sorts of things. But Scully has very kindly, and I think this is actually going to be very important, he's been patiently watching the process of all of this, wondering what substance there is, and he's kindly offered to give us a few concluding remarks on whether we were more successful on process or substance, or whether me as the moderator is going to start doing substance abuse very soon.
Well, thank you very much. I won't keep you very long, but what I want to do sort of is to also sort of overview a little bit what the workshop has been at least telling me, and to some extent also related to the objectives of the Prospects Network in general, which is maybe primarily to bring together empiricists and theoreticians and maybe integrate that with genetics to bring forth sort of a new dynamic view of speciation. And so I want to take this back to and relate it to the process issue, the process thinking that I made a statement about in my talk, and sort of polarize, not necessarily polarize, but just sort of analyze the empiricists and the theoreticians a little bit with regard to this, in a very positive way, by the way. And I'm going to approach it simply from this hypothesis that I threw up in my talk about that it was actually ecology that was driving the process thinking. And now I've learned so much during this meeting that I can say a little bit more about it. So first I want to emphasize that if we look at the empiricists, and now let's just define them as the people that are looking at adaptive radiations, rapid evolution in polymorphic groups of fish or finches or butterflies or whatever, they are the empiricists in this sense. And not so long time ago, like Jim mentioned so well here before, these people were arguing about, have meetings about whether these forms were all allopatric or sympatric, blah, 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 genes, environment, blah, 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 all very substance pattern kind of orientated. And that's sort of where it stranded. But when this research continued, people discovered through direct ecological observations, and of course through comparative research and natural experiments, with the aid of these beautiful genetics that tell us now that local divergence actually occurs in nature, that's how they discovered ecology and started formulating process-oriented ideas and hypotheses and theories on at what states of divergence their speciation process might be, or whether there might be reversal in the speciation process. They, of course, studied and study still sexual selection and all those issues that are sort of trying to complete this complicated story. That's the introduction of the process thinking. And maybe the reason why I emphasize this is just to explain this, because in the workshop we had in Iceland, where we had quite a lot of these people, we had everybody there as well, you know, all the different views, but this was the main conclusion of that workshop, that maybe the cutting edge issue for at least this kind, that kind of research was the process introduction. Now here we have, or I have to say, maybe from my perspective, I've been learning so much from these community, population, ecology discussions here, and how the theoretical, the theoreticians that are coming from several different sources, but they all come from that source though, are really telling us that they have been bringing in process thinking to the niche concept, to the adaptive dynamics processes, all these issues that have been discussed, and I'm not going to repeat anything about that here, but these are issues that are, have clearly moved from a substance-oriented thinking to a more process-oriented thinking. I mean, when I studied ecology first, I learned that a niche was something related to a species, and that was some kind of a fixed entity. And so I think that even though we feel that we've been, that this is all very long time ago, and you know that we don't think that way anymore, it's just important to realize that it's not so long time ago that this was happening. And an important aspect of this process thinking from this perspective, from the community and population ecology perspective and theoretical perspective, is how that is then connected to Darwin's ideas on population dynamics, like what Liz has been emphasizing so much. And it's sort of bringing back Darwinian thought into speciation research. So, my argument now, and maybe part of my learning experience or hypothesis now about this meeting and what is maybe going to happen in the future in the prospects meetings, is that here we have brought these two groups together, or these two process thoughts, the empirical process, where ecology was discovered sort of directly, and the process concept from the theoretician's point of view, which has evolved somewhat independently. So we're struggling with combining these two things here, as we've obviously noticed. And like Ule's comment here earlier was a direct introduction, I'm not going to repeat that, of how these things need to be connected. And the theoreticians need to parameterize their models maybe more with regard to the real world. We all agree on that. Any good theoretician would agree on that. But also the good empiricalist, and this was sort of amplified in the argument here yesterday that Andrew Huntry made statements about the niche, is that, of course, the empiricists need maybe to learn quite a bit about the niche concept and the way it's used, and how we are have to look at the... Well, I'm sort of thinking about the diagram that Kaisa put up here in the beginning. So that's sort of the burning front I would identify. And I think it sort of culminates a little bit in the idea that we are interested in the process of divergence. I mean, this has been... And this sort of overrides the discussion of sympatry, parapatry, and allopatry, like has been mentioned here earlier. And I think that maybe just to conclude on why all this is process, I haven't mentioned substance at all here, but it's just to emphasize where we are, that Jim sort of, I thought he was destroying this for me when he brought it up, but after all, it was actually a very strong, good that it came up earlier, is that I was going to say here at the end that in this meeting, in the workshop in Iceland, in the meeting in Luxembourg, in Austria, in December, nobody mentioned species concepts. It's not an issue. I mean, Jim brought it up, but he did bring it up in the context that I appreciate. Jim, that's what I said. But it is done to emphasize how much we have been taken away from the substance thinking in evolutionary biology. So that's sort of, I'm glad that we are not having a session on species concepts anymore. So that's sort of my analysis in my kind of amateurish philosophical style. But I really appreciate this meeting very, very much.
Please, I think he deserves a round of applause, and thank you. And I hope as we kind of migrate that way to please, you know, chat with any of the people or whatnot. And wow, thank you all for sticking around longer than we had intended. But I think it was worth it.
that meet in Lake Balaton and swim. It's very nice weather and enjoy your time afternoon. And we may continue discussion either here outside or in the lobby if you would like.
I'm not sure whether we reconvene. So thanks for everybody for coming. My greatest worry was that this afternoon, which I left open, will not work. Thank you for Joel for this show, and of course everybody who played in the show. Thank everybody who helped in the organization. I thank Ben, who gave me 5 megabytes of picture. I will post on the website or on Facebook. Of course, the video will be posted, except if you say not to post your lecture. What can I say? Of course, the whole thing would not exist without Ake and Ulf and the Prospect Cooperation, which gives us the money and the IASA financing of the excursion and the dinner yesterday. So thank Ulf and Ake. I know that it is a huge work for both of them to have this beautiful network, and thank you for coming, and go to the day.
The dinner will be in the small room where the welcome party was, because they have a big event here for veteran sportsmen. And therefore, we shall go to the smaller room where the first evening we met. There will be the dinner.